Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Madeline Carey. She's a Wild Earth Guardians Gila Campaign Fellow. Born and raised in Albuquerque, Madeline spent her childhood exploring the Rio Grande and its bosque on foot and on horseback. In May 2014, she graduated from Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts, with a degree in biology and urban studies. While at Tufts, she was a four-year member of the track and cross-country teams and a trip leader for the Tufts Wilderness Orientation Program. During college, she spent her summers working for the Bosque Ecosystem Monitoring Program, researching American pika in the Valles, how do you say it, Valles Caldera?
Valles Caldera National.
Valles Caldera National Preserve, and working with the New Mexico State Forestry to create a post-wildfire assistance guide. So thank you so much for, A, your work, and for, B, being on the program.
No problem. It's my pleasure to be here and speak with you today.
So I would like to talk about Mexican wolves, and as we've said in our correspondence, I think you can presume that people know, that people are sympathetic, but they don't know much about them. Can you just give me a background on Mexican wolves?
Absolutely. So Mexican wolves, like many of the iconic North American predators, really fell victim to Manifest Destiny and the westward expansion, and were entirely extirpated from the southwestern United States where they're native to. And they're a genetically distinct subspecies of the gray wolf. They're different than the northern Rockies gray wolves that we have up in Yellowstone. And it was in the late 1920s, really, where there were government-hired wildlife hunters and wolf hunters whose job was to go out and shoot and kill wolves to make room for the public lands ranching industry in southwestern New Mexico and southeastern Arizona. And there, by the 1970s, all of the wolves had been extirpated from the southwestern United States, and there were only, I believe, 7 wolves found in the wild in Mexico. And those 7 wolves were trapped and brought up to the United States, and they started a captive breeding program that was incredibly challenging to get started, A, because the wolves were incredibly stressed out from being trapped and transported, and B, because there was only one female and the rest of the wolves were male. So from a genetics perspective, you had to do some really creative calculations to ensure you weren't going to get into a bottleneck that would compromise the genetic integrity of the population. And the Mexican wolves were one of the first species listed on the Endangered Species Act in 1973. And there has been an ongoing recovery effort to return them to the wild since then. And it has been a long and arduous and complicated process, mostly for social and political reasons and not for environmental or ecological reasons. The first wolves were released down into the Blue Range Wolf Recovery Area that straddles the border of Arizona and New Mexico in the Gila and Apache Sitgreaves National Forests. They were first released there in 1998 with the goal of having 100 wolves on the ground within 5 years, because 100 wolves were seen as the natural the population level at which you would have a viable breeding population in the wild. And today, in 2014, there are 83 wolves in the wild in 16 distinct packs between the two states. And this is and the program has largely not been able to meet its goals because of conflicts with the ranching industry, as well as with pets and sort of social pressures for removing what are viewed as problem wolves. Most notably, there is a 3-strikes rule. There is a 3-strikes rule in the management plan where if a wolf is known to depredate on cattle and kill or harass cattle 3 times, it can be removed permanently from the wild. And this is obviously problematic for a lot of reasons. First and foremost, it's removing individuals from the wild when you already have a population with extremely low numbers, and it is North America's most threatened carnivore, so each individual matters. 2, wolves are incredibly loyal individuals, and once they form a breeding pair, those two tend to move around together, and it's very disruptive to the pack in their social structure to remove one of the breeding adults out of a pack, and that will, and removal of one of those adults can impact the likelihood of the offspring surviving. And three, because the captive wolf population and the population that's being reintroduced was bred from such a small gene pool, each wolf carries a unique genetic value, and they basically have not been able to release wolves of high genetic value into the wild because they're concerned about losing those individuals and losing their DNA, either to having to do management removals due to conflict with human use of the land, or having them be poached. That's been another big issue, is people see these wolves and they go out and they shoot them, regardless if they're harassing their cattle or their dogs or not. And so there's been some successful prosecutions of wolf killings, but it's incredibly challenging to track down the responsible individuals. And even though we're, you know, over a decade into this reintroduction program, and there has been a lot of on the ground effort to develop coexistence strategies and change livestock management to, so livestock can cohabitate with predators in a harmonious way, there's still a lot of social and cultural resistance. There were two wolves shot and killed in October, down on the New Mexico-Arizona border. And they are in the ecosystem that they live in, so the Greater Gila Bioregion is what we call it. They're the only, we're one of the few large apex predators. There used to be grizzly and jaguar in the Gila, both of which have been extirpated as well, and neither of which have a current reintroduction plan. And the wolves are really playing an important role in moving around ungulate and prey species and offering relief to streams and riparian areas that have been overgrazed. And so there's, you know, a lot of people are probably familiar with the wolf store in Yellowstone where the aspens and willows were dying, and they reintroduced the wolves, and the wolves moved around the elk and the deer, and then the riparian areas were able to come back, beaver were able to come in, there were more birds, and it revitalized the whole ecosystem. And the Gila is an incredibly wild place and an incredibly large wild place. There's over 3 million acres of designated wilderness or wilderness quality roadless lands in about a 10 million acre area. And the wolves are playing and will continue to play as their population becomes more robust, a very important role in helping this area recover from a lot of the negative impacts of public lands grazing that's been occurring there for about 100 years.
Well, thank you for that. That's a completely fabulous overview. And I'm wondering if we can go now, sort of go back and pick at some individual parts.
Yeah.
Like, what was the original range of the Mexican wolves pre-conquest? Do we know?
Yes, we have a vague idea. It's hard to concretely know pre-conquest, but they were up basically into northern New Mexico, down all the way south into the Sonoran Desert. They've found remains of wolves and wolf-dog and wolf-coyote hybrid in indigenous sites in Mexico. And wolves played an important role in some of the indigenous cultures in Mexico and in their practices and in their spirituality. And it was very closely related with sort of the warrior persona and being a very proud and loyal character. And so they have found those remains and those archaeological sites, which gives us the notion, you know, in modern day, looking essentially south of the Grand Canyon down all the way into north central Mexico.
You said that there were 7 wolves in Mexico that were caught. Was that the entire population of Mexico? Are there no Mexican wolves in Mexico now? I didn't understand that.
So they believe those to be the last wild wolves. Although, again, it's hard to concretely know that, but the general consensus in the scientific and the environmental community is that those were the last wolves. And there actually are wild wolves in Mexico now, and they've had an I don't want to say extremely successful reintroduction program, but they actually had a pack of wolf puppies born in the wild this summer, which was really special and exciting to have that. And you know, Mexico is a different governmental structure than the United States and has a lot more large tracts of private land where it's harder to have these government-run recovery programs coupled with the political instability of that region right now. It makes it more challenging to run these big reintroduction programs, but they are working on it, and that'll become a very important part of sort of the continental conservation of wolves, is when the U.S. population is able to link up with the Mexican population.
And you just said that they had puppies in Mexico. Have the wolves in the U.S. been reproducing in the wild?
They have, and again, an interesting part of this genetic diversity issue is one of the mutations that has arisen out of the inbreeding is that the McBride lineage, which is the lineage that has most often been re-released into the wild, tends to produce fewer puppies per litter than the historic literature cites Mexican wolves producing. What we see in other lineages, they generally tend to have 2 to 3 puppies per litter rather than 5 to 7, which slows your projected population growth. But they are having pups in the wild, and they actually this year cross-fostered some pups into a pack where they took some puppies that had been born in captivity, and they released them near a den site where they knew a mama wolf had just had, I think she'd had 3 pups and they released 4, and she has been raising them as her own. And they did that sort of mix up the genetics. And that's a really cool science experiment that has massive implications for furthering this conservation effort and getting a more diverse gene pool on the ground.
And she accepted them and brought them in?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, which was really cool to see. I don't know what the hard science behind that, but it was really exciting.
And I don't want to get too much into hard science, but it you said there's only one female, and how did they get around that genetic bottleneck? Did they bring in coyotes and then cross back? It's because it seems if you only have one female, that's a terrible bottleneck, and you're going to end up with terrible inbreeding.
No, I don't have the specific, lineage that they threw out, but I think they genotyped. My guess is they would have gone in and looked at the genotype of all the wolves and found the ones that were most distant and bred the female to one of the males. And then if she'd had a female pup, that female pup would have been bred to one of the different males. And there's a lot of complex genetics you can get into in looking at what are acceptable inbreeding markers on certain genomes and which ones aren't, and which ones will, you can have a range of mutations from death at birth or infertility to having only 2 pups per litter. And the science is good enough now and wasn't quite as good back then, but it's good enough they've been able to develop a program that's sort of only breeds acceptable mutations into these wolves.
So I have one more random question, then we'll get back to some more sort of systematic questions. The other random question is, I just read yesterday about a northern wolf that who has been seen at the near the Grand Canyon. And historically, do you know how far was there any overlap of territory of the timber wolves and the Mexican wolves?
There likely was. And, that was a really exciting story for us because it shows that continental conservation and really looking at protecting species on a continental scale matters, because this wolf likely traveled 400, 500, 600 miles by herself to get to where they found her. And there likely was mixing between those two populations. And then either due to weather patterns in, you know, some amount of climate change or variability or humans moving in, those two species, those two populations got separated and then became genetically distinct. But it's likely that there was some crossover, but probably not a huge amount.
Oh, I guess I have one more random question before we go back. And that's, you said they're the most, didn't you say that they were the most threatened carnivore in North America? Did you say that?
Yes, and that is, they're definitely the most threatened wolf species. And in terms of, when you're saying most threatened carnivore, you're looking at a whole host of things. And there's, you know, several carnivores that could garner that. But basically, due to the sort of the social and cultural persecution these wolves are facing, as well as the situation with their genetic diversity, they are one of the most, if not the most. Another one would be the lynx, and grizzlies. They're actually talking about delisting, which is another one that people think is one of the really threatened and endangered carnivores. And the grizzly recovery effort has actually been much more successful than the Mexican wolf recovery effort, because they've been able to leverage Yellowstone National Park. But if they're not the most threatened carnivore, they are one of the top three to five.
The two I was thinking of were, Florida panthers and, red wolves, but those are different subjects too.
Yeah. They're, you know, they're all up there, and I don't.
Yeah, this is not really
a great master's project to write a paper on which one's the most threatened.
Yeah, it's kind of a useless
term. They're all incredibly threatened. Yeah, they all need a lot of help.
All.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me also, what's the difference between most of us have seen at least pictures of timber wolves. And what's the difference between that and a Mexican wolf in terms of, are they smaller? Are they different color?
They are smaller and they are a different color. Mexican wolves tend to be about 60 to 70 pounds in weight. And, so about the size of a Labrador, rather than, timber wolves are much larger. I have a 100-pound German Shepherd, so it's hard for me to sort of use dog breeds as a scale because he's oversized. And they are a yellowish gray color. They tend to be lighter than the timber wolves. And they, have some black down their back. They have much more similar coloring to what most people would imagine a coyote having than the timber wolves and the wolves you see up in the northern U.S. and Canada.
So, okay, let's go back to the recovery program. And what are the current plans for what's happening now? And what is the, once they get to 100, then what are they going to do?
That's a great question that everyone asks. Right now there's actually a new rule that's about to become official, in January, I believe, that we've gone through a big process the past 2 years, commenting and talking to Fish and Wildlife to make sure it's meeting the conservation community's goals, as well as, they have to listen to the ranching community. And the new rule is going to expand the habitat for the experimental population, and it'll be in New Mexico and Arizona. It'll go from I-40, which is a big highway interstate that goes just dead center through the two states. Albuquerque and Flagstaff both sit right on I-40. It'll go south from there down to the Mexican border. And it'll go all the way over to Texas and all the way over, to the Arizona California border broadly. So they're doing a massive range expansion, because currently if wolves are found outside of the much, much smaller range, they can be trapped and moved back into the range, which from a scientific perspective doesn't make sense, because there's usually one wolf every 40 to 60 square miles about, and obviously you can't have 100 wolves inside of an area that doesn't fulfill that habitat need. And so this new rule will expand the area in which wolves can be, which will help us get a lot more wolves on the ground. The bad part of it is it does make it easier for individuals living in that area to shoot the wolves. There are much looser restrictions on the takes that can happen. And, you know, my view from 10,000 feet up is that Fish and Wildlife knows they just need to get more wolves on the ground in order to meet these conservation goals. Once they get to 100, they will again look at changes in management to support that, although I think the general understanding is that they're not going to suddenly delist them. They're not going to suddenly stop doing active management because there are these strong social pressures from the ranching community and just total resentment of the wolf and of the recovery effort.
You know, I interviewed someone a while back, and I've lived in the West my whole life. Grew up in Colorado and then lived in Nevada, Idaho, Eastern Washington. And something that I've not been able to understand is the extreme hatred of wolves on the part of many rural people. And is that I know that you're from the Southwest and not from the Northwest, so you might not know about Nevada or Idaho, but is your experience or understanding that the hatred of wolves is just as strong there among many rural people as it is in some other states? And do you have any explanation for it? And do you think it's getting any better or any worse?
Yeah, and this is sort of my favorite question to talk about because I spend a lot of time thinking about what is the American West sort of philosophically, ideologically, politically, emotionally. And to me, the wolf offers a really interesting study of that question because it is such an iconic part of the American West in terms of literature and movies and the stereotypical representation of the American West, as well as sort of modern pop culture references. The University of New Mexico Lobos, their mascot is the Mexican gray wolf.
Oh, wait. So is the, you know, Otto Leopold's famous green fire, was that a Mexican wolf and not a timber wolf?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That was a Mexican wolf. And the way I've sort of thought about the hatred of wolves is I think there is a lot of wolves are very, very common in mythology, and it's sort of split 50-50 how they're represented. And a lot of sort of Eurasian mythology and what we would sort of say modern Western thought, they tend to be tricksters and not cast in a totally benevolent way. And I think that sort of the very Christian expansion and settlement of the West maintained that sort of fear of wolves that comes out of literature and mythology that was very common in Europe. And, you know, then to continue past that, we eradicated all of our predators and we totally romanticized the notion of the cowboy and the rancher as these incredibly rugged, incredibly adept, incredibly independent and free Americans and sort of the ideal American, which in reality doesn't exist. The majority of public lands ranch, all public lands ranchers are dependent on federal subsidies. And the wolf is seen.
And many of them go by the name of Anheuser-Busch.
Yes. And so for me, a lot of the hatred of the wolf and it stems from that, the leftover mythology from Europe, but it also stems, the reintroduction efforts are seen in a lot of areas as an overreach of the federal government, of the federal government doing too much. You know, it's this idea of ownership of the land and not just of their private land, but of the federal grazing allotments that they're on and the ecosystems and watersheds that they live in. And it's this sort of, you know, conquistador-esque mentality that, you know, my grandfather came out here and settled this land and I own it and I therefore dictate the lives of all the beings on it. And when you suddenly have a federal recovery program come in and try and reinstate this totally wild, iconic image of the American West, It's very threatening to sort of their understanding of their world and their place in it. And, part of me that is a compassionate human understands it's threatening and terrifying for them. But I just, you know, that total fear, hatred, and loathing, I think, has very little to do with the actual, you know, biological species of the wolf, and a lot to do with the fact the world has changed drastically since the West was settled, or the West was won.
Or lost,
more correctly. And it's, you know, it's just this total fear and loathing of federal government oversight, which is very misplaced if you understand how rural economics work at all, and that they're largely dependent on, you know, federal government input and subsidies. And that's where I think a lot of this rural hatred comes from, is people move out to be away from society, and they see these federally run reintroduction programs as a intrusion into their, you know, private kingdom.
Well, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I also just need to comment that I can't believe that you only graduated this year, because, you know, I have to tell you that you are infinitely smarter than I was at your age. So I just want to sort of publicly acknowledge that.
Well, thank you. And, I'm blushing. No one can see.
And I guess a couple of things I want to ask about that. One is, there's a story I've heard about how in the Northeast, soon after the Europeans arrived on the continent, a whole bunch of American Indian nations got together and spent some time asking the question, why are they killing all the wolves? And they spent some time talking about this, and the only thing they can come up with is they're crazy. That's, you know, they're just nuts. So everything you say makes a lot of sense, and at the same time, it's like, this is still just crazy. And that actually leads to the next thing, which is, I know that in Washington State, for example, that when a cow is killed by a wolf, that on public lands, the rancher will get, I believe it's triple value for the wolf. I think it's triple value if it's verified, and it's double value. No, it's double value if it's verified, and it's single value if they just think it is. And from a purely capitalist perspective, what you'd want to do then is just tie up all your sheep and cows and have them eaten by wolves, because you get more than you do from the market. But they don't do that. In fact, there are ranchers up there who say, we don't want any payment at all. The only payment we want is dead wolves. And so there's this level of just complete insanity on it. So I guess the next question is, well, two questions. One is there a program like that down in the Southwest where when the ranchers, when there is some sort of depredation, I don't want to call it that, when there are sheep or cattle who are removed from the public lands by the wolves, are the ranchers paid? And second, the other part of the question is, are things getting any better, or are things getting worse in terms of public attitudes among the rural people toward the wolves?
Well, we do have in the Southwest a compensation program if there are depredations on your livestock. And there is actually a new council that Guardians is not part of, because we a little bit disagree with the direction it goes in. But it's called the Coexistence Council, and they'll actually pay ranchers just for the presence of wolves on their public grazing allotments, which to me is a very it's getting to point B. But it's really ethically backwards to me, that you are paying people to accept things on land that they don't own. You know, you're like paying someone to tolerate an opinion that they don't like.
Well, hey, you know what?
But
you know
actually, what? Guardians is running something.
Wait. I should be paid. I don't like the fact that there are cows on public lands. So why don't I get paid for that?
Right, exactly.
I think all the ranchers should pay me personally.
I'd love to propose that to the... Yeah, you can call the National Beef Cattlemen's Association and propose that to them.
Okay.
Let me know how it goes.
Yeah, I think it
But Guardians is working on sort of a slightly different angle, which is just, So Guardians is working on a totally different aspect of it, which is just removing the resource conflict between public lands ranchers and wolves. And we're running what we call a voluntary grazing permit buyout program, where we compensate public lands ranchers at market rate to waive their public lands grazing permit back to the Forest Service. And this then closes the allotment to cattle. And right now, we don't have federal legislation, so any closures we do are just for the term of a grazing permit, which is 10 years. And then the district ranger can decide whether to reopen the allotment to grazing. And the one closure that we have done was an allotment that had a wolf den on it. It had, I believe, three other endangered species and had been severely burned in wildfire. And so the rancher was having a hard time managing it to range standards, and it was causing the Forest Service a big headache. And so they were actually really happy to close it. And we're sort of looking at this as a model both for the Gila and a way in which we can really provide space for the wolves to be wild, but also west-wide as a way to change the dialogue about public lands ranching. And because we are paying market rate, we're giving these ranchers a very large sum of money that we fundraise. And they're either, you know, it's a bit the golden saddle. A lot of these guys are old in retirement age. The average age of a rancher in the Gila is 61 years old, I believe. And a lot of their kids aren't interested in taking over the ranch, and so they're faced with a tough choice. And the fact that we can a lot of these ranchers in a very interesting way, they're like you and I, they actually really love wild places and wild things, but it's just through sort of an anthropocentric point of view rather than a biocentric point of view, in conflict between the recovery effort and the ranching community. And there are allotments, there are ranchers that I talk to, I guess, to your second question about, you know, have attitudes changed? I would say yes, because the ranch and a lot of the people that are coming in are.
The call quality is really diminishing. I can't hear you. Are you there?
Cells are.
Wait. The call dropped out for a minute. Can you back up?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, sorry about that. You were just talking about how you had just started to say that there's a change in attitude that you're seeing, and then the call dropped out right then.
Okay. So the change has been over 50% of the public lands grazing allotments in the Gila have changed hands in the past 10 years, and the not all of them, but a lot of them, are now the grazing licenses are now owned by people who are hobby ranchers and are coming to it as a second career, and they're not trying to – they're sort of out there playing cowboy. They're not from a third or fourth or fifth generation ranching family. And I have – you know, there's a group of ranchers that are really friendly to buyout and see it as an effective – land management tool for the Forest Service to use, because they think the Forest Service allows too many cows on the lands. And there's this really great old guy who he's in his late 80s. He's sick. He's and so hopefully we can close his allotment before he passes on. But he has lived in the Gila since the 40s, and he remembers hearing wolves when he was 15. And he'll sort of look you in the eye and say, you know, I want to sit out here on my porch and hear wolves again, because, you know, I've heard them once or twice, but they just don't howl like they used to. And then he'll bend in real close and he'll say, well, don't tell anybody, but when are we going to bring the jaguars back? And there, you know, there is a demographic of ranchers out there who totally love wild places and wild things. And that's why they're living out there, eking out a living, because they just love being out in the middle of it all. And unfortunately, what happens is a lot of the stories that get told in the media are the Clive and Bundy stories, or the woman who runs the New Mexico Cattle Growers Association just hates wolves. And, you know, they tell stories about wolves chasing their children, which we all know are not true. And that's the voice that the ranching community gets in the press. And so there's, which is really probably only 15% of the ranching community really, really hate wolves. And I would say 15% love wolves. In the middle 70 are sort of, they're not going to publicly come out and say, oh, I love wolves, but they're probably not going to just shoot a wolf out of total malice either. You know, they're a little bit like, if the wolves leave me alone, I'll leave them alone. They're sort of ambivalent towards them. And I just think the narrative gets very skewed by the powers that be in the ranching community.
Well, that's really heartening to hear. And it doesn't surprise me about the narrative getting skewed, because we know what happens within a capitalist society that way.
Yeah.
But the thing that, yeah, that makes me really happy to hear that about the 15%, because I've actually had experience with, it's not a lot, but a fair number of ranchers, and in Nevada and Idaho and Eastern Washington. My experience was that for the most part, they did pretty much hate the wolves. So it could be that my experience was just unfortunate, you know, that I happen to know. It's not a large number. It's like maybe 5 or 6 ranchers total. So maybe I just knew 5 or 6 who were particularly nature hating. So that's really, really heartening for me to hear. Thank you for telling me that. Another question I was going to ask. Now I forgot it. So the Forest Service has been amenable to this idea of.
That's a generous term. So forests have, there's a general supervisor who supervises each national forest, and then there are districts, and each district has a ranger. And we have certain district rangers that really like this option because they have ranchers that are incredibly problematic in that they don't maintain their fences, they don't brand their cattle, they don't, you know, do whatever necessary repairs, they don't follow their annual operating instructions on their permit. And so and a lot of times those are the same ranchers that are sort of like, oh, you want to write me a big check? You know, I can handle that. And, so we have district rangers who are like, yes, absolutely. Let's partner and sort of remove a couple of the bad actors from the landscape. And we also have district rangers who grew up in the ranching community and went to the big land grant university in the southern part of the state. And they'll look me in the eye and tell me that I'm anti-American and I'm trying to end the ranching industry, and that they will under no uncertain terms work with me. And so it's a mixed bag. And theoretically they're, you know, a nonpartisan agency and they just follow the rules, but that is not true. And so when we can partner with them, we do, but there are times when we can't, which is why we're really trying to get some federal legislation passed by Congress that would authorize these permanent closures if the rancher chose to waive their permit back, because that would let us circumnavigate the local Forest Service staff.
Yeah, the reason I was bringing that up is because I know that in Washington State, when various environmental organizations would attempt to buy out timber sales and then not cut the trees, the Forest Service would invalidate the timber sale and sell it for cheaper to someone who was actually going to cut the trees.
The agencies definitely have their own culture, and the timber sale thing is wrapped up in wildfire and how we manage wildfire. And, you know, the grazing, because of the Endangered Species Act, the forests are under a lot of pressure to make sure they're not doing anything too egregious. And so, yeah, you know, there are people that just think we're not doing anything good and that cows are actually beneficial for the landscape, which is a myth of gigantic proportions. So, you know, we have to pick and choose the Forest Service individuals we work with, but for the most part, they're at least polite when they decline to work with us.
Well, that's a step, I guess.
Yeah.
So I guess there's just a few minutes left, and the first question is, I guess two major questions left. The first one is, presuming, what is your realistic scenario for the near to midterm future for Mexican wolves, and what is your reasonably best case scenario for Mexican wolves in the mid to near to the near to midterm future? So 5 to 10 to 15 years. What is your realistic scenario, and what is your realistic good scenario?
All right. Well, so I guess my realistic good scenario, so what I hope happens and could theoretically happen, is that we get federal legislation to do grazing permit buyouts, and we're able to close, say, 10 to 15 allotments over the next 5 to 10 years in the Gila. And by doing that, a little bit change the conversation and loosen the stranglehold the cattle industry has on the public lands politics in that region. And by doing so, alleviate some of the pressure for the Mexican wolf. I think definitely in the next 5 years, the population will be over 100, and that hopefully with their expanded territory, there'll be some fewer conflicts with humans, because you won't have as many wolves packed in on top of each other, and that there will be more cultural acceptance of the wolf as there are more of them, and as they potentially become easier to go out on a wildlife viewing expedition and see. Because that's something that we struggle with, is we don't have Yellowstone. You cannot get in your rental car and drive down a road in the middle of Yellowstone and see bison and wolves and bears and geysers. You know, you can drive down through Catron County and you can see, you know, a bar and some cattle, but you don't see wolves that way. And that is challenging from the social acceptance perspective, because, you know, right when you see a wild animal, you sort of bond with it in this way, and we can't provide that yet. And so my hope would be to see sort of increased ecotourism and increased interest in the wolf from people who are not members of the ranching or the conservation community, just sort of people going out, experiencing the American West. Now, the realistic situation is it's going to be really hard to do federal policy in the next 2 years because of what happened with Congress. Who knows what's going to happen in 2016? It, you know, things can always happen. DC is a total poker game. But my guess is that it's going to be really challenging, but not impossible, for us to get this federal legislation done in the next 2 years. I do think, even in a totally realistic situation, they will get to 100 wolves in the next 5 years. And the cultural stuff, I think, is going to be almost a generational thing. And I say that sort of looking at agriculture and who's involved in agriculture and who's involved for what regions, what reasons, and agriculture broadly, both sort of, you know, the urban local sort of conscious food movement has really caught on broadly with, millennials sort of in my generation in a much more encompassing way than it has in the past, I feel. And I think that that will help people think about the cattle industry and the cattle industry's impact on the Mexican wolves, and as well as it will sort of change the dialogue away from public lands being sort of a grocery store and a feedlot, and more towards a place where we sort of play and adventure and explore, and that there are places for wild things to do the same thing. You know, that's, I think, fairly realistic. I don't think we're going to have total social acceptance of wolves in 5 years.
You know, this may be a really silly idea, but you know how, like grass-fed beef and local ranchers, that, I'm just thinking about this because of what you just said about the whole, you know, the change in the, I don't remember exactly what you called it, but basically the eating movement, the food movement, mm-hmm. in the past several years. I wonder if one could also in a wolf region then start movements toward like wolf, you know, I only buy beef from a specific rancher who is who is friendly to wolves.
Yeah, there's actually someone in New Mexico who was selling predator-friendly meat, I think is what it was called, and I don't remember the name of his ranch, otherwise I would give it to you. And there is – I actually have a rancher who I end up buying lamb from sort of as a business doing more often than I would like to, but it is – it's kind of cool because I meet the rancher. I know exactly what land he's on. I know exactly how he views the world and how he sort of acts out in the wild. But a big roadblock to that is the regulations on slaughter and the availability of processing plants. And this has been changing slowly. Like there's actually a guy in New Mexico who drives around in like an old bus that's been retrofitted. And if you're a small rancher who raises 10 to 15 cows a year, he'll help you slaughter all your animals. So you can do more of that direct sort of producer to consumer avenue. The problem with that on a broader scale is just how the USDA regulates slaughtering and processing of beef products, which is very strictly, and they make it really hard to be a small operator who can commercially sell their hand-raised and hand-killed meat products.
You know, I'm not – okay, I want to be really clear. I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I think I've been really lucky in my experience because I buy a cow at a time, and I've always been able to choose the rancher living here in Northern California. For whatever reason, it's worked out. Maybe that's because there's a mobile slaughtering unit or something. I don't know exactly what the details are. I know
you can,
I approach ranchers and say, I want one of your cows.
That's totally true, and that's how it works here. But that's because it's direct from you to him, and there's no middle, there's not like a farmer's market or a co-op involved to do any sort of commercial sale to be, which is not a prerequisite to being an economically sustainable operation, but can definitely help sort of create more of a market.
Right. That makes perfect sense.
But yeah, my family has done from me to you. You have to meet certain guidelines.
Right. Okay, well, the last question is, so really the reason I do all these interviews is because I want for people to do things. I want for people to get off their butts and actually be activists. And so if people are hearing this interview and they either A, live somewhere else in North America except for the Southwest, or B, live in the Southwest, what can they do to help Mexican wolves?
Great. Well, one big thing you can do right now is the National Defense Authorization Act, which is the one piece of legislation that always gets passed on time, is probably going to get passed later this week. And it has some really bad public lands riders attached to it that sort of extend the reach of grazing and allow them to not follow a lot of environmental regulations. And so if you live in the American West, writing to your senators and saying that you disapprove of the inclusion of the Grazing Improvement Act of 2013 will be hugely helpful, just so Western senators know people are thinking about this. And that's my general, what can we do to help, is the more Western senators are hearing from people that public lands grazing affects wolves and affects predators and affects quality of life for Western residents, the easier it is for them to take a stance against the incredibly powerful beef lobby. And it's never going to be easy to do that, but the more support they have from more of the residents, the better. You can always give to Guardians, which my development people always tell me I have to say. And the other thing is go down into the Gila, stay at the little bed and breakfast, go out on a hike. It's an incredibly beautifully wild, spectacular place. And when people ask you what you're doing, tell them you're there to see the wolves. And they're going to say, oh, don't say that. Or they're going to look at you funny. But the more that region accepts that its economic future is going to be in people seeking out wild experiences, the quicker they're going to move on social acceptance of wolves. And so if you are within 500 miles, if you're in Arizona, if you're in New Mexico, if you're in, California, plan a weekend over to the Gila, and there's great resources available on the internet, and go tell five people that live in Catron County that you're there to see the wolves. and that'll do a lot to help the wolves have a more wild existence.
Well, thank you so much for your work. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Madeline Carey. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.